What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X, and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Being a chef means keeping your cool in the kitchen. And with Resi Priority Notify and Global Dining Access through my Amex Platinum card,
right this way,
it's nice to try someone else's food for a change. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
What's up? This your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
It would be very clever PR if Liv, of all the players, just said, we love the USGA. They're the stewards of the game. We believe in them, and we're going to follow their lead. And whatever they want us to do, we're going to do, because it would be so counterintuitive, right? You know, they've got all these spiky personalities, and these guys like to rage against the machine. Like, that would be a way to get in the good graces of certain golf fans, but it's just not in their DNA.
I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out, trying not to think what I'm thinking about. I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out, trying not to think what I'm thinking about.
Hello, this is Alan Shipnuck, back from another Fire Drill podcast with Michael Bamberger. Mike, thanks for doing this, as always.
It's a pleasure. How was the travels for you?
Yes, I'm coming in hot from Tucson. I was at the Live event, and it was edifying. You know, even though I've been there so many times now, and I'm always learning more about how it works, and that's their model's constantly evolving, and they're making changes. And a lot of us, I know a lot of fans on Twitter don't seem tuned into the results on Liv, and I don't think you are either, Michael, which is fine. I'm not here to shame anybody, but as a business story, it's utterly fascinating. Even if you're not into the golf, I mean, they're going to be at the MBA program at Stanford. They're going to be talking about this disruption for decades. This happens in businesses, but rarely is it this public and with this much star power and all the geopolitical overtones. Like, it's just a fascinating thing. So I wrote a story for firepitcollective.com, posted yesterday after the tournament ended. It's gotten a big response online because people are just, I think they're just happy to learn something new, because we feel like, I mean, even me, as close as I am to all of this, all the stuff happened in the shadows. You know, it's all the conversations, all the negotiations, all the deal making, the betrayals, like, it was kind of out of sight. And then little bits leak out here and there. But so it's fun I talked, I don't know how many players I talked to, but easily over a dozen, and got a key Liv executive on the phone for about half an hour. And that's really hard to do, you know, in the midst of the antitrust lawsuits and everything. Everybody's running scared, doesn't want to talk to any reporters. So it was great for me personally to learn a lot more about what's happening out there. And I think, you know, readers have appreciated that insight that I can pass along.
It's a very edifying piece of journalism that you wrote, and it's one that you're not going to read anywhere else except for on our website, because there's no other reporter who is devoted to actually getting the story as you are. I'm going to tell you what my biggest takeaway was from it, Alan, and then you react. My biggest takeaway from that is that despite the enormous sophistication of the Saudi business leaders who are putting this thing together, is there is a fly-by-night element to this, even with the hundreds of millions and literally billions of dollars invested. And what I took away from your story is they don't really know what they're doing. And I don't mean that positively or negatively. It's just that was my takeaway. Is that a fair, unfair? You tell me.
That's totally fair. Another way to phrase it, and this is like Mickelson made this point in his press conference. I didn't put it in the story, but he said, things change, things evolve. And we're nimble enough and our leadership is flexible enough to respond to that. You know, that like in his mind, this is good governance, that they're willing to make these changes on the fly, as you say. I mean, for instance, they had kind of this, they have a 10-year plan, and the way, and what they're doing this year was really going to be for next year, but they felt like we have so much momentum. We've signed more players than we expected to. Let's go all in and speed things up. And that's created some of this discord, I guess would be one word for it. But most of the players are like, this is great. I mean, we're trying to get somewhere, and the faster we can get there, the better. So your response is completely valid. The live side would point to that as good leadership, where you're willing to update your plans based on how things are playing out on the ground. So, but it's both views are valid. I mean, there is an element of like, they are winging it. And that can be good and bad. And by, you know, to accelerate their business plan by a year, I think it was certainly the right choice. I mean, Liv is crying out for an identity beyond the Saudi money, and the team thing, I think, has a chance to be really compelling. I mean, I've been there now these last two events. I like the uniforms. I think it's a really cool look. And just for me personally, it helps. It burns into my brain who's on which team, because I'm, you know, they've changed a lot since last year. And there is a very palpable camaraderie amongst the teams. Like, they play their practice rounds together. They all set up on the range together. They have dinners together, and the way they've organized, it's not an accident. You know, like the all Aussie team, like they were throwing a rugby ball around and having fun in the lobby of the Ritz-Carlton. You know, these are just fun loving characters. And, you know, Kevin Na's Ironheads, it's kind of this pan Asian team. And obviously Danny Lee got the win yesterday, and you could see his teammates. They look like they were emotional about it. Danny Lee was all choked up, and we hadn't won anywhere in the world since 2015. And he said, like, this team has changed the way I play golf, because I can't take a single shot off because I know my teammates need me. It's on a very basic level. I mean, the most stressed out I've been on a golf course in the last year was you and I, Michael, when we played the Uncle Tony Invitational at Bandon, because I wanted to play well for you. And it's a very human feeling when you have a teammate you care more. You know, if I'm off playing and just for some buddies and we're playing for $10, if I play bad, it's on me. They're happy I played bad because they're going to win more money. And, you know, you get down on yourself, but you're not letting anyone else down. But as soon as you have a teammate, the emotion is so different. And even these players who are guaranteed money and they've had these long careers in some cases, like, they're feeling that on a very human level. And I think it's kind of cool. And as, you know, there's an all Latin American team. There's, you know, the Westwood Poulter Stenson, you know, it's these old Ryder Cup war horses. Like, they've grouped these teams in ways that make sense. You have an all South African team. And you used to see this on the European tour, right? Like, all the Spaniards would travel together and eat together and play practice rounds together. And then they would use these teams in the Ryder Cup because these guys had this palpable chemistry and this history and this shared language and culture. And that was one of the keys to the European Ryder Cup success, is that they took these small bonded units of players and they use that to their advantage. And Liv is kind of doing the same thing. And so whether the fan at large will ever be invested in these results, that's the ultimate question. But the players are, and that's a big step forward, because it's going to be hard. It would be hard for the fans to ever care if the players did not care, but they definitely do. And so that was an important first step, and I think that justifies Liv speeding up its model here to get more buy-in from the players and to get them literally more invested in their team. So that's a success for Liv again, and I think it does help blunt the criticism of all these guys have guaranteed money, they don't care, they're just going through the motions. Like, if you're on the grounds, you can feel how much they care, and you can see it. And I mean, like, on Friday when the first round ended, you know, all the players come in at the same time. And so it's kind of a melee around the scoring area because everyone has to turn in their cards. And, you know, Phil Mickelson saw Brendan Steele and he's like, "How'd we do? What's your number?" You know, it was cute. Like, and you can see the players are looking for each other in that area. They want to know. I mean, there's scoreboards out there, but you always want to get that final confirmation. And so the players are definitely invested in the team thing. Again, the TV numbers weren't great. Whether that's the ultimate question is whether the fans can get there, but I think they made the right call.
It's another thing that comes out very clearly from your story that's on our website this today, that they're going to lean way more into this team concept than we even thought originally. And I guess that's also it's very much tied into how the Saudis can actually make some money from this venture. But Alan, just from your own observations or from reporting or otherwise, the tradition of team competition is an incredibly rich one, whether it's national pride in the Olympics or city pride, like in baseball, football, basketball, hockey, the Ryder Cup, of course, continent versus country. Has there ever been a case where teams have sort of just, and I understand that they've done a very good job, very clever of putting these groups of like-minded players and similar backgrounds together, but in terms of, but that's okay for them. How does that translate to fan interest? Is there a way to actually do that? Can you really create fan interest when the starting point is we're getting the team together in the interest of making money?
Yeah. So that the interesting thing, the crowds in Tucson were pretty good. I mean, it's obviously Phoenix Open is a long time tour stop. Tucson used to have, you know, the Tucson Open, which our colleague Jeff Ogilvie won. That was his first win. You know, Phil won in Tucson when he was in college to launch his career. It was kind of a minor stop on the tour, but a lot of great players won there, including Arnold Palmer and others. That went away. They got the World Match Play at the same course, the Gallery Course, for a period of years. But, you know, they played it in February and it almost snowed a few times. It's not an easy course to walk, but the crowds were good because Tucson has a golf history. And for instance, the Fireballs, which is, you know, Sergio Garcia and Abe Anser and, you know, two other guys whose native tongue is Spanish, they had a good gallery of Hispanic fans out there. And you could hear some of the conversation, you know, vamos, like some of it was in Spanish. And so in that very small sample size, the model worked. You know, they grouped these players together because they're all sort of representing Latin America in some way. And the fans found them and they cared about them in a way that they wouldn't have otherwise. And I thought that was interesting. Now, you know, I'm sure there's some kids in Australia or South Africa who care about the Rippers or the Stinger because they're all Australian or they're all South African. And, you know, if you grew up in a certain era and your North Stars were, you know, Charles Schwartzel and Louis Oosthuizen, and now they're teammates, and they've been your favorite players for a long time, you're probably going to be a little more invested in that team. And you know, same thing, if you're an English fan of a certain age and Lee Westwood and Ian Poulter were your gods, like now they're playing together and, you know, they have Sam Horsfield, who's another British gent. So, I don't know what the scale of it is. I think they will pick off some fans because they've made it very tribal, and I think that was smart. Interestingly, it's the top Americans that don't really have an identity so much, you know, because I think Phil's kind of low key going for like a West Coast vibe, you know. That's Brendan Steele's a California guy, but you know, like Bryson's team is an absolute mishmash. It's Paul Casey, it's Anirban Lahiri, and who's their fourth player? Now I'm drawing a blank, but there's no natural kinship there, right? Like, oh no, and it's Paul Casey, who's an English gent. It's like it doesn't quite fit the, you know, who are they? What are they? And even their name's the Crushers. So well, they're not really long hitters, so that doesn't work either. Like, some of these teams are clearly struggling for an identity, and I don't know how they're going to solve that except through maybe through attrition. You know, if I mean, I'd love for Bryson to go all in and get three players who just swing for the fences, and whether they could actually score and play real golf would be fascinating. But you know, if you're going to call yourself the Crushers, you can't have an Indian guy who drives at 260 like Lahiri does. It just doesn't quite work. Like, what is, who are you? Right. What are you? So they haven't fully baked it out, but I don't know. It's going to be, to me, it's kind of fun and funny and the whole thing. You know, I will say the merchandise, it sells in small batches. Like the Bubba's team, the Range Goats, has a really good logo and they have really fun colors. And in Mexico, all their stuff was sold out by even the Pro-Am day. And it was gone in Tucson really fast too. Like, they clearly need more quantity. Some of the stuff has become kind of a kitschy collector's item in a way. And so I think they will be able to sell some merchandise, and that becomes a revenue stream. It's not a big one, but it's something. And some of the logos and, you know, are kind of awful, and I don't think anyone wants to wear them, but some of them are well done. So the identities and the branding of the teams has potential. It really does, but it's still a work in progress.
Did you get to catch any of the telecast, and what were your impressions of it?
Yeah. So when I'm in the press room working, they have the telecast on. There's no sound, which is kind of my preferred way to watch golf anyway. I can't really comment on the commentary. But it is, the irony is that the LIV golf telecast is what golf Twitter demands and bitches about every weekend. You know, that you're lucky to be immune from the discourse, Michael, but a big faction of golf Twitter is there just to complain about TV coverage. I mean, every Saturday and Sunday, it's just endless and not unjustified. But I was talking to someone who's part of the LIV broadcast. Well, he's behind the scenes. He's one of the shot callers. And he said they average 150 shots per hour, and they refuse to show tap-ins. They never show tap-ins because they think it's boring. Unless a guy misses it, they'll show it. But otherwise, no. So it's 150 real shots and putts, and that they've looked into it. And on CBS and NBC, the average is 50 to 60 an hour. And so the LIV telecast is like bang, bang, bang. Like, it's shot to shot to shot. And of course, there's not the commercial load because they don't have the commercial sponsors yet. So that's not totally a fair fight. But, you know, I was especially watching on Friday. That's when I was in front of my computer a little bit more. And that's the streaming version when there really is no commercials. And it's a dream for a golf fan. And it's just, there's no filler. I mean, they are just showing golf shot after golf shot. And on an interesting desert course, where guys were hitting it, you know, offline and getting in trouble, and there's a lot of runouts and really challenging short game shots, and there's drivable par fours. It was fun to watch. I mean, just as a golf fan, like, I like watching Cam Smith play golf. I like watching Dustin Johnson. I like watching Abe Anser. You know, these guys are mega talents. And so if you can, in a silo, in a vacuum, if you can declutter your brain from all the other things and you just like watching really skilled golfers hit really interesting golf shots, like, it was great fun. But you know, the numbers haven't been there so far, and you know, this year their ratings are very low, and so I guess I'm slightly in a minority opinion. But the
I had that exact moment, Alan, watching just a little bit of the telecast. You see a guy over a shot, you see a caddy and a player talking about a shot, you see a player watching a putt roll to the hole, and is it in or out, is it going to fall or not? And it looked just like a PGA Tour event, except for the shorts. There were definitely moments like that. Highly skilled golfers playing golf. We've been watching that on TV literally all our lives. So at some level, it is just another form of golf. You know, and then I think the question is, are you going to care? Can they make you care? Can you make yourself care? Are you so distracted by, you know, it's sort of like what Rory says, you know, we're not just competing with LIV, we're competing with TikTok. There's so many demands for our time. It's like, and I understand that people were, you know, I watched one episode of the Netflix series. I didn't think it worked at all, the Jordan Justin one. And I consider, like we all do, my time to be valuable. I don't care to watch anymore. So I wrote up the one and said, That's it for me. Now, people have told me that there are many other better ones, but the point here is that there is tremendous competition for our time. And that's going to be, as you say, there's a lot of moments when it's just watching really skilled golfers playing golf shots. But can you make us care about the results? Not you, but can the Saudi organizers, can LIV Golf make us really care about the outcome? That's always going to be an enormous challenge for this league. And I don't understand really why on Sunday they can't find another way to change the format so not everybody is finishing at once.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, the inspiration for everything LIV Golf does is the Premier Golf League. And I've read through the 116-page prospectus a number of times, which LIV leaned on heavily. And they had a shotgun start for the first two rounds. But on the final round, they went to a traditional, you know, everyone goes off the first tee, leaders go last, recognizing that you kind of want that traditional drama. That's a departure for LIV. And it's probably a mistake. I mean, they do send the leaders off last. So the leaders will go off one. The guys, the nearest pursuers go off two. So they're trying to get the drama on the final holes. But even so, it's, I mean, that's another thing I like. You talk about the attention span. I like that all the players start at the same time and everyone's on the course at the same time. And the whole thing takes, you know, 4.5 hours and then you're done. It's a dream work day for those of us in the typing trade. And I think the fans like it too. I mean, to be at a tour event in the sun for 10 hours is, that's not easy to do. And if you're, you know, we talked about this on a previous podcast, but all your players that you want to watch are out there and you just have to find them instead of, you know, waiting for a morning and an afternoon wave. So that's one, to your point that and I was talking to, you know, I have four teenagers and we were just talking about how the media has changed. And I was sort of lamenting that, you know, the things that I value, the long form, the richly reported pieces, whether it's on golf or on anything. And I know you're the same kind of reader, Michael, and we have the same taste. And Olivia, my 19-year-old, she's like, that's dead. Nobody cares. She's like, if you can't tell it in a 60-second TikTok, nobody cares. And it was like so harsh and funny, but obviously true for a growing percentage of humanity. And so, I mean, to LIV's credit, they've tried to adapt to that. Like, let's give you a more easily consumable product. It's 3 days instead of four. It's 4.5 hours instead of 12. Everybody's out there at once. And, you know, a lot of these things are held against it as a critique, like, oh, it's not real competition. It's not 72 holes. And shotgun start is for, you know, it's for charity fundraisers at your local hospital. But they're sort of trying to acknowledge that the tastes have changed among the consumer. And they're being belittled for it. But if my entire market research are the people in my house, then I would say they're onto something. But I don't know. It's an interesting debate. But you're right. Getting the average golf fan who's used to the traditional venues and the traditional way of doing it, can they get them to cross over? I did a speaking thing at Stanford Golf Course not too long ago, and it was 60 people in the room. They were having a member guest at Stanford, so a learned crowd and obviously serious golfers. And I asked, like, how many of you have watched a LIV telecast? And I was surprised. It was probably a dozen hands went up. That was more than I expected. And they, you know, there was a curiosity factor there that, you know, now they're in year two. I mean, people either like it or they don't. I guess if they can, I mean, this is one of LIV's fundamental problems right now is it was built on star power. Like, they're like, let's cater to the biggest names and give them what they want so they'll come play on our tour. But it's the journeymen who are winning. I mean, Charles Howe, he was a cute winner and it meant a lot to him. And he contended again. Danny Lee, you know, he was choked up. He was emotional. Like, the idea that these guys don't care, you know, Danny Lee unable to speak after the win would probably counter that narrative. But you're not going to build a breakaway league on Charles Howell and Danny Lee. I mean, they need Phil to find it. Bryson is playing terrible golf. Cam Smith, you know, he's been okay. Dustin's kind of cruising along. Like, you know, Brooks, I would say those five guys could really move the needle. If you have Brooks, Dustin, Cam, Phil, and DJ, like, they could break through the clutter, and they're so compelling to watch, and we're invested in their stories that, as golf fans, I think they could make a difference. But the Danny Lees and the Charles Howells, as charming as they are, I mean, that's a problem for Liv. They need their biggest names to start bringing it, and they just haven't really. I mean, Dustin and Cam and Brooks each won once last year, but they've kind of faded away. And so I don't know that there's definitely, you don't want the journeyman to carry Liv Golf. I mean, now it's again, how we talk about things. You have this kid, Taylor Moore, not really a kid, but a guy trying to break through at Valspar. And that was totally celebrated. Like, this is, and I see this in my mentions, this is what the PGA Tour is about. It's guys changing their life and getting the break they always needed. And that's why it's so compelling. And I think we all agree with that. But if a guy like Danny Lee, who hasn't won anywhere in 7 years, and this is a career altering performance, and he's found a purpose, like, people kind of shrug and go, oh, he just won a bunch of money, that's why he cares. It's like, I mean, his career just got jump-started in a huge way, but it's not celebrated in the way that sort of an unknown winning on the PGA Tour is. So that's another perception problem for Liv Golf.
A couple, that triggers a lot, Alan. One thought is, your four teenagers in the house are an incredibly important dynamic for golf, because they're very interested, bright kids, interested in the world. They're active in their own sports. They're not golfers. But golf traditionally has been able to take in the ordinary sportsman for the four majors and for the Ryder Cup especially, no matter what their interest in golf. And that's why those numbers have been those numbers. Those events, as anyone your age or my age would know, they're a crescendo. They lead, they build, and then they explode. And what your four teenagers are saying is, we don't have the time or the patience for that. So it's an enormous challenge for golf going forward. CBS is finding this with their Masters telecast. You know, the Masters is the ultimate example of that. To really appreciate Sunday afternoon, you have to be along for the ride. To some degree, Thursday, Friday, Act 1, definitely Saturday, Act 2, where you get to know the protagonists, and then you're all in for the third act on Sunday. But if the nature of storytelling has changed so fundamentally that doesn't hold up anymore, like as might be the case in the Shipnuck House and millions of other houses, then that's a basic problem for golf in this narrow sense. It's a basic problem for golf in the broadcasting of golf to millions of people. Now, as you and I, you know, for me, that's not golf. That's some little sliver of golf. Even like when Jeff was in our podcast the other day and he's talking about, you know, the golfing celebrity and their ability to sell the big headed driver and the hot ball and the titanium shaft and all the rest. Even that's just a sort of sliver of golf. But what you're talking about illustrates a huge problem for golf on TV going forward.
Well, and even Augusta National, I mean, you know, we know how geriatric that membership is, but they get it. Like, you know, the guys kicking around beach balls in Amen Corner last year was a curiosity, you know, Dude Perfect, but that was an attempt by Augusta National to reach all the people under 30 out there who don't want to hear the treacly piano music, and they don't get teary eyed thinking about Gene Sarazen's 5-wood, you know, like there. And if, I don't know if you saw this little teaser they released on social media, you know, they have kind of these hipsters hanging out.
I thought that was great.
Yeah. Having like a little Masters party, like whether you liked it or not, it was at least Augusta National has realized we can't keep selling ourselves the same way because it's old and it's tired. And
how about Fred Ridley last year? Are you talking about the Dude Perfect guys?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, so they're listening to their grandkids. You know, they all have grandkids the age of my kids, and they've gotten the message, like, we've got to reinvent ourselves a little bit. So it's just an interesting time. I mean, we've talked about this a lot offline, how the golf media has changed, and it's you can lament it or you can just try and keep up with the times. And it's certainly you know, like, I don't know if you've noticed Kevin Van Valkenburg, since he went to No Laying Up, he's been writing game stories just as tweets. And you know, I read in his mailbag.
So he's been writing game stories that what else?
Just as a series of tweets, not even posting on the website, but just a thread of 20 or 30 or 40 tweets that bring to life some aspect. And, you know, he talked about it in one of his mailbags. And I was just talking to Kevin on the phone the other day, and we went through it a little bit as well. That he's like, well, that by the time you get that edited and posted, it's, you know, it's nighttime, and then they're playing golf again the next day. And it's just kind of, it feels like it's, you lose the audience. And whereas you can just put up on Twitter more with more immediacy, and folks will consume it, and it'll get them excited that you're there. And maybe they'll be inspired to look into more of the things you have done. But, you know, for you and I to imagine going to, oh, we're going to be at the Masters together in a couple of weeks, like, to not write every day and not to put it on our website and try and, you know, do a more traditional, longer form story. Like, it's hard to imagine a world where we didn't do that, but, you know, maybe we're just dinosaurs. I don't know.
We write for people who like the pleasure of sitting down and reading something. And Kevin does too, but what Kevin's figuring out is that they're reading in a different way. And your four kids are giving that message all the time. Alan, in your week there, did you talk to anybody affiliated with LIV who thinks the so-called rollback of the golf ball would be a good thing for golf? I can kind of guess the answer, but I don't want to guess.
Yeah. It. Yeah. You know, we know that LIV is predisposed to attract the rebels, right? The nonconformists. And they're not stoked about the rollback. I mean, they're trying to sell an entertainment product. And, you know, one player who I'm not going to say by name because we were just kind of bullshitting, but they're like, are they going to make us use a gutta percha? Like, he's like, this is ridiculous. Like, what is USJ doing? They're living in the 19th century, which, of course, I don't fully agree with that analysis. But, you know, if your motto is golf but louder, you're not going to be in favor of a quieter game, a more contemplative game. it just doesn't work. So
it really plays right into their hands, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, totally. So no, I didn't hear much support for the rollback, but you know, that LIV is getting more into the governance side of things. You know, last year was just a chaotic launch, and there's so many moving parts, but they're, you know, this player meeting that I staked out in the lobby of the Ritz-Carlton. I mean, they're going to go to a drug testing policy this year, which they have to do if their players want to play in the Olympics and those sort of things. They're instituting a slow play policy, which every professional tour needs. So
that was funny. The quip you had where the one guy said, if it's as effective as the PGA tours, watch out.
Exactly. But honestly, the pace of play out there, I think, is pretty good. I'm always surprised. Like, I'm doing something, I'm like, oh man, they're going to be finishing here soon. Like, I mean, they're playing in about 4.5 hours. We're on tour, it feels like it's taken 5.5. But the point is, they're introducing more structure and more real decision making. So at some point, they're going to have this discussion. Do we want to abide by the rollback or not? I think ultimately they will have to, because LIV Golf knows that a lot of its credibility is going to be determined by how the players perform in the major championships. And if all the tour guys are playing the USGA by the USGA rules, which will be, you know, that's what the majors are going to do, right? They're not going to defy the United States Golf Association. So if the Masters and the PGA and the British Open have the rolled back ball, the LIV guys can't rock up those weeks having played a different ball most weeks. And so I think ultimately they'll be in lockstep with whatever the tour does grudgingly, but they're not going to hide their disdain. But I, you know, that's one of the fascinating subplots is both LIV and the PGA Tour don't have to follow this local rule. They can do what they want as an organization, but I think they're going to have to mirror each other. And I think LIV's of course going to take its cues from the PGA Tour because the ultimate proving grounds has become the majors and you don't want to put yourself at a disadvantage there. So I think they'll be grumbling, but ultimately they'll go along with whatever the tour does.
Alan, just as a quick aside, and then I do have another LIV question for you, but just as a quick aside, what do you think about the idea of the USJ and the RNA trying to develop a ball just for the four majors where Pebble Beach and the Old Course, Mary and many others would still be have meaningful part, Augusta National would be meaningful, and then maybe try to sell that ball down the road to the PGA Tour as well?
I just think it's so problematic because these guys are so highly optimized with their equipment and they to play the game a certain way, you know, 48 weeks a year and then the other, and then 4 weeks a year to have to learn different trajectories, different carry distances, tweak your equipment, different shafts, different whatever. And those are the four most important weeks. I don't like it. I mean, that would be essentially if basketball for the NBA finals just raised the rims 6 inches, which would probably make the game more interesting. And the players are skilled enough. They'd be able to play the game, but it would be different. And, you know, all of a sudden the shooting percentage would drop dramatically and it'd be Brick City. And it'd be like, what's the point? I mean, now you're really creating two different games. And, you know, Mike Clayton, we had a whole conversation offline about this stuff. And he said, well, that's exactly what happened with the British ball. You know, people forget that this did happen. There was true bifurcation in the game 40 years ago when they introduced this different ball through the RNA, which is different from the USGA, and players had to learn a different ball and they were able to do it. But that was before TrackMan and that was before a lot of, equipment advances. And so it could work. I mean, if you told the guys you can't play the Masters unless you play this ball, they're going to play that ball and someone's going to shoot 272 and win the golf tournament. I mean, it would happen, but I think you would in some level it diminish the majors because there'd be so many guys being like, what? This just doesn't feel right. This is not the golf I know. This is not the golf I've grown up. This is not the skill set that I've honed. And maybe that's a new school view, but I mean, it's funny to me still, even though I've seen it for a while, when guys are playing practice rounds, they have a, you know, their manager or their caddy, they're carrying their TrackMan. They set it down for every shot now. And even in the practice rounds, like they've got these little sling things, they carry their launch monitors in and, every shot of every practice round and pro-am is on the TrackMan. And, you know, we talked about this with Hale Irwin and Jeff Ogilvie on Need a Fourth. I mean, for old school guys like that, it's horrific. Like it makes their faces melt. But again, times change and habits change. And so I don't like the idea of making the players learn something new and adapt just for those 4 weeks, which are the ones that really matter. What do you think? I mean, would you be in favor of it?
I'm in favor. I think it would be neat. I think it would actually elevate the majors. I think in tennis, they've got different balls for all the different surfaces. And I think we're so focused on what the players want. But I think what the fan wants is for us to see them playing golf as we play golf, which is now you're a long hitter, but on any par five that you and I have played many over the years, if you bust to, maybe you'll be in a greenside trap. It's not 3 wood, 4 iron to a par five. That's not a par five. So if you had a ball that would reintroduce the actual concept of a par five, the long par four, the long par three, I think that would be a real positive for golf. And if it only happened at the four majors, especially, and the others were viewed more as entertainment, I think it would be cool.
Yeah, these macro issues are so interesting. But did you have a chance to watch Jordan Spieth, the Jordan Spieth experience on Sunday? I mean, that it's just never boring.
He looks like he's shooting 40 for any nine holes of golf he plays. Can't believe when you look at a board and see he's 8 under, 9 under, could possibly even win the tournament. It's just bizarre, actually bizarre. I don't see how this particular golf he's playing could possibly hold up at Augusta National.
Well, and he has these periods.
Not
where
that we're not rooting for him, because we are.
We are. I know. And like, he hit a, it's just, he's so mental. I mean, he hit a bunch of greens in regulation on Sunday, but then he missed 3 of the last 4. Just like, you know, Bay Hill, he had all those one putts, and then he missed all those putts coming down the stretch. And 71st hole, really tough par 3 at Valspar, flags it, best shot of the day, and misses like, what, a 6-7 footer. Like, Jordan, it's exhausting. It's painful.
Alan, I got one more ball question for you.
Oh, please.
I know
please.
A lot of people. What did you see Bryson's joke thing about, you know, his proposal for the USGA, and then he swings like grandma?
Yeah, I did.
What'd you think of that?
Bryson is so fascinating. I mean, I've actually been talking to him a fair amount. All these events, some guys don't want to talk about anything. I'm asking Bryson tough questions about a lot of things, and he just answers them, which I like, of course. And
that's neat. Does he have handlers around when you do that?
He does, but I just ignore them, and I just walk right up to Bryson, and we have, you know, I've been covering him a long time.
Yeah,
and
that's neat.
Bryson's cagey. I mean, he knows I'm writing this book about LIV Golf and the PGA Tour. And I think he's obsessed with status, and he wants to be a voice in the book, but that's fine as long as, and he gives me like really good answers. I have a strong BS detector, and I feel like he's being really straight with me. So, the handlers are always around, but I don't even make eye contact with them. But, he's playing terrible golf. I mean, he's finishing like 46th, 47th, but he's trying hard out there, man. I mean, I did my least favorite part of this job is the driving range vigil. When you want to talk to somebody and they're, you know, it's after the round and you're like, okay, they're going to hit one bag of balls, and he keeps sending this guy back for more and more balls. I mean, he was there till dark, and it's not like he's not putting in the same amount of time. He's just not getting the results. But the thing about Bryson is he's just, and you see this on all the things he does on social media, he's just not quite as funny as he thinks he is. And I mean, the USGA bit could have been good, but it wound up being a little cringy. That's kind of like a lot of the things he does. I guess it's cool that he puts himself out there, and he's trying to engage his fans, and he's trying to, you know, be a content creator, but it's just always like slightly off. But, I guess you got to applaud the effort. I mean, we want the fans to, I mean, we want the players to engage with fans. We want them to embrace social media. I mean, Bryson does all that, but it's just like 2 degrees away from being like really good. But, I mean, yeah, he's the loudest voice against the rollback for sure, because, you know, he feels personally oppressed, and he's a guy who's devoted his entire professional career to finding new advantages and exploiting any little thing he can, and it just feels like they're stunting his progress. But he does look good. I mean, he's lost a lot of the weight. He looks strong. I mean, he looks thick, but not bloated, and he looks a lot healthier than when he first embraced. He went down that road of just trying to bulk up. So he just remains an enigma. But I do like watching him play the game, and I do appreciate that he's still obsessed with golf, and he's still trying to get better at it, even though the evidence is to the contrary.
Well, he should be in his prime trying to get better at it. He should absolutely be in his prime.
I know. Yeah, it's true.
So something really, really, really weird is going on that we don't know. But just to follow up on something that you just said, you see, to me, Bryson mocking the USGA, as you say, you know, he's off by 2 degrees. He thinks it's funny. It's not really funny. But to be sort of serious about it, his career is defined by two things. I mean, the great muscle packing and weight gain, you know, aside, the U.S. Amateur win, the U.S. Open win, Those are the great championships of the USGA. And to be so disrespectful to an organization that what, and they've gotten a lot wrong, and I'm not standing here as a USGA committeeman or anything remotely like that, but they do create the game by which he has been able to separate himself from the crowd as an amateur and as a professional. I don't know. I know he's trying to be funny, but I don't think it's funny at all. I think it's dumb, and I think it's disrespectful. And I think it, and I think it's why a lot of people are just sort of annoyed at LIV Golf, because I think if the LIV people want to do what they want to do, they should do it, and it's great. I don't personally think it's great, but they could, it's a free world, you know. To the degree that it is a free world. But I think Bryson DeChambeau, I don't even like to use the word "should," but I'm using it here, could be a little bit more respectful to the organization that created these championships that have really defined his golfing life. I find it offensive, really, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, well, I always appreciate your traditionalist take. I mean, it would be very clever PR if LIV, of all the players, just said, we love the USGA. They're the stewards of the game. We believe in them, and we're going to follow their lead. And whatever they want us to do, we're going to do, because it would be so counterintuitive, right? You know, they've got all these spiky personalities, and these guys like to rage against the machine. Like that would be a way to get in the good graces of certain golf fans, but it's just not in their DNA. I mean, it's just not.
You know, it's funny ways you say that, Alan, because, like, you know, I've talked to Norman a lot over the years. I know you have as well. And of course, he's very critical of the PGA Tour. I have never heard him say one critical thing about the RNA, Augusta National, or the USGA. I never have.
Yeah, and for a guy who was pretty star-crossed in the U.S. Open, I mean, he had a few chances to win, never did.
Did he ever say this U.S. Open course joke is the setup here is a joke? Never. I never heard him say anything like that.
Yeah, you've talked about this very eloquently in other podcasts. The USGA had this elevated position in the sport. They were, your term, they were like the stern father who lorded over all of us. And I think Norman still has that reflexive kind of reverence, even though he is a muckraker and he does like to stir the pot. And of course he was under the aegis of the RNA coming up anyway. And I think the RNA even more than the USGA is held in esteem because it's these tweety old gents who invented the sport. That is interesting, but
Alan, would this be an appropriate venue for me and us to extend an invitation to Norman, Greg Norman, commissioner of the LIV Golf League, to join us on Eda 4th and discuss his feelings about the USGA, the RNA, and Augusta National?
It would be. Okay. Don't hold your breath. So I bumped into Norman out on the course during the Pro-Am in Tucson. He was just there, and he's always on the move. Like, he's a really hard guy to pin down. They don't bring him into the press room anymore. Like, they've really tried to keep him away from reporters, which is probably a smart move because he just always takes the bait and he loves to pop off. But there he was. And so I walked up to him and I was like, Greg, you know, I've been trying to get a hold of you for a long time. And we had this moment last year in the parking lot at Portland where that was right after coming in hot after London, and I got booted out of the press conference and he's looming over my shoulder like the Grim Reaper. And we talked in the parking lot for half an hour at Portland and had a meeting of the minds, and he was apologetic and about that whole situation. And I told him that I was doing this book and I really wanted to sit down with him. He said, okay, mate, we'll do it. You know, come to my office in Florida. And we shook hands on it, and he's been dodging me ever since. And you know, I've texted him and he keeps saying, I'd like to, but I can't, not the right time. You know, everyone has a boss. Greg Norman has a boss. And so they've pretty much muzzled him. But anyway, I don't care. So I walked up to him. I was like, Greg, we got to talk. I got all these questions for you. He's like, I'd love to, mate. But, you know, and he had a cart. He's like, I got to pick my son up, who was like 50 yards away. He's like, we got to be over there. I said, okay, well, how about after the Pro-Am? Like, I'll meet you in the lobby at the Ritz. We can sit down and have a drink. He's like, this afternoon, slam. I said, okay, dinner. I'll buy you dinner. You can order the wine. He's like, I got a dinner thing. I said, fine, I'll meet you after dinner and we can, I'll sit in your hotel room. I don't care. Just tell me where and when. He's like, it's a crazy night. He's like, I got to go. And he like zooms away. It's like, well, you can't try any harder than I'm trying, but he doesn't want to talk. I mean, no matter what Greg Norman says, people are going to pounce on it. And he has a tendency to say the wrong thing anyway. So there's no upside for him other than there's, he could explain things in a detailed way. He could offer some depth and context. I mean, of course that it would be helpful for my purposes, but I think he just, the cost benefit analysis, if he slips up and says one wrong thing, I'm not in the gotcha business, but he's just done it to himself where, you know, when, I mean, one of the top Liv executives quit last year after Norman's quote about, you know, the Jamal Khashoggi murder, like, oh, we all make mistakes. Like, this guy like resigned in protest, you know, like there's actual ramifications to his words. And so if he says the wrong thing, the stakes are just too high. So the chance of him coming on Need a Fourth are slim, but I like that you're putting it out into the universe, Michael. Who knows? It's worth a shot. Anyway, so one of the pleasures of my trip to Tucson was that I've been reading your book, The Ball in the Air. I'm like 80% done, and what we're going to do, that comes out next a week from today, and we're going to do a special pod to talk about the book. But it's such a joy because it's a very intimate, charming story, and you're so immersed in the lives of these golf lifers. And I'm trying to find some, I got to finish it today because it's, I just like finishing books and I want to see how it ends. I mean, I have some insight on the life and times of your protagonist, but anyway, that I had.
That's neat. Thank you, Alan. Yeah, you can find time to read with all you got going on, 4 kids, book, job, and the rest. But you are in plane, so that helps.
Yeah, and actually, on Friday night in Tucson, they were really long days, and I came in a little rundown anyway, so I was like kind of doing room service and just not really venturing out. But I went out Friday night to this cool part of town. I think it's called the Warehouse District. It's near the University of Arizona. I didn't realize it was St. Patrick's Day until there was all these like people dressed in green and having a lot of fun. And I was like, oh, it's kind of fun energy. But I long ago stopped caring about like eating in restaurants by myself. I know some people are self-conscious, you know, when you travel for a living, that's just what you got to do. So I wound up in this very bustling pizza place and I was reading your book and I've got like the greasy smudges on some of the pages to prove it. And I didn't realize it, but I was kind of on the way to the bathroom. So there's like a lot of foot traffic where my table was. And 7 or 8 people were like commented. I guess it's just weird to see someone reading a book these days. Like if you're by yourself, folks are on their phone, right? Like that's how people pass the time if you have to eat a meal alone. But to have a hardback book with kind of an elegant cover, you created a lot of conversation. I think I sold some books for you in Tucson.
Okay, I'm going to leave you this one thing, Alan. So the Farrelly brothers, great guys, great golfers. I don't know if they're great golfers, but they're trying to pitch Bill Murray on a script. I think the movie was called Hall Pass, and they sent him, and he has no agent, and he's got no anything. And they got an address for him on some island off of South Carolina, probably just Kiowa or something up that way, Sullivan's Island. But anyway, they got the address. They sent Murray the script that they wanted him to read, consider the role. To your point about pizza smudge stains on the pages, the script came back about 9 months to a year later. Every single page had a coffee stain on it or some kind of stain on it. Dog-eared. He obviously read the whole thing. No note, no anything. And I think it was Peter Farrelly told me that was Bill Murray's way of passing. In other words, he was going to do
just send it back.
But, that's amazing. You know, at least he took it seriously. And you know, I'm looking at a Philip Roth book I'm reading right now. It's a good feeling to look at something. It's got a little bit of you, not to get too graphic here, but once you've read something physically. But now our son Ian Bamberger is a very avid reader. He does all his reading on, not all, but most of his reading on Kindle. So anyway, it's a generational thing, as we're finding out. Many things in life. Yeah. Alan, thank you for representing the fire pit so well in the uncharted waters of Live Golf. It's an excellent report, and I know there's going to be a lot more where that came from, and nobody else is doing it. I had a period in my life, I've had periods in my life where I followed baseball obsessively. And within that, I've had two periods where one, the labor strife, this probably goes back to the early mid 80s. The labor strife was as interesting to me as what was happening on the field. I don't know why. It just really interested me. I'm not knowledgeable about it, but there was a guy, Murray Chass, who wrote it up for the New York Times. And then much later, in the Sosa McGuire period, of course, there was the home run thing. That was fascinating, and I was way into that. But really, the question of drugs in baseball, it was like a sideshow. It was unfortunate, but it was weirdly, weirdly fascinating. And I know that a lot of people have that for LIV Golf and what's happening right now. They're really interested in what it says about the person who's either rooting or not rooting for LIV to succeed. And I don't know. So I get it that people really can't get enough of it.
I mean, this story that posted on our website, I mean, the amount of engagement in the comments, it's 20 times what I could have gotten from, you know, a Jordan Spieth story at the Valspar. And yet everyone says, I don't care about LIV Golf. You know, I don't follow it, but they read the stories and they react to them. And so I think you're right. I mean, it is a window into so many different things, and it's quite a big story in our game, and it's we're going to keep feeling it for years to come. So it's hard. That's my thesis. It's just hard to ignore. Whether love it or hate it, it's hard to ignore. And
yeah, because it's going to reveal character. How you feel about it will reveal character. Just like Bryson's, you know, dissing the USGA because they think the ball goes too far. I mean, it's a legitimate position to have, whether you agree with it or not. I know he's trying to be funny, but it just reveals something about Bryson. So this is a great, you know, the Scots have said for a billion years, golf undresses a person, they would say today, but golf undresses a man. And one's attitude about LIV undresses the person as well.
All right. This is another fire drill. Thanks to the listeners. We appreciate your fidelity, and we will be back in your ear soon. For Michael Bamberger, this is Alan Shipnick. That's the end.
I bet big and I played to win. Made a fortune when my ship came in. I ran the table, never thought I could fall. Then the wintertime hit me like a cannonball. And now I can't shake this losing streak. Every road I take is a dead end street. I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about. I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like...
Whoa.
And...
Hmm.
Not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.